Welcome to the Awakened Collective, where we explore the topics of love, spiritual consciousness, and our divine purpose on this planet. Join us as we uncover the truth that our thoughts shape our reality. Welcome to the Awakened Collective podcast. I'm Rick Gregory, and it's so good to be with you today. Thanks for joining us. As always, I want to remind you that you are the divine extension of your Creator's love on this planet. You have never been separated from your Creator, and we have never been separated from one another. Our thoughts really do shape our reality. And I want to thank Danny Anderson and the Audio Alchemy Productions for all that they do to help us get our messages out. Well, I want to also say that the thoughts and ideas expressed in this podcast are my own and those of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the thoughts, ideas, opinions of Audio Alchemy Productions and their staff. I have a very special guest today. I've titled this podcast From Acquaintance to Dear Friend, and I want to share something about this special guest before I turn it over to her. So I have known our guest this morning for several years as an acquaintance from social circles. We're friends on Facebook. Well, one day, my husband Glenn mentioned to me that she had reposted something I shared on Facebook, and it was a post by Jim Palmer. Now, Jim, I've tagged you in this Facebook video. Because you have impacted my life. So it was something I had posted with regard to Jim Palmer. And Jim was the pastor of the largest of evangelical Baptist church in the country before he had a spiritual awakening. He is now the founder of the Center for Non-Religious Spirituality. I would highly encourage you to check it out. He's helping people to recover from religious trauma. That is a thing. And I've read many of his books, I think all but one. And this one happens to be my favorite. It's called Wide Open Spaces. It's one of my favorites of his. And so I put this out on Facebook, and Glenn tells me one morning, he says, "Hey, did you see that my guest this morning reposted your post on Jim Palmer?" And I thought, I've known this person for a few years, but you know, sometimes you can feel kind of lonely when you're on a journey that may seem a little different than other people's journeys. And it's always comforting to know that there are folks out there who share your ideas, who share the way that you see the world. And so I was really excited when I heard that she had posted this on Facebook. So I'm retired, so I get to take naps from time to time. And at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm like, I'm going to take a nap. So I lay down. And I was in bed for probably 5 minutes, and I jumped up and I said, "I'm taking the dogs to the park." And Glenn looked at me like, "What?" And I'm like, "It's beautiful out. I'm going to take the dogs to the park. We're in a new home in a new area, and it was a park I had never taken them to before. And it's never easy getting 4 dogs to the park, but I managed to get them in the car, and we went on our little trip to the park. And no sooner did I get to the park and get settled with the dogs, guess who walks into the park with her dog? And it's my friend CJ Garrett. And, you know, those divine appointments, we were just talking about it this morning. She mentioned serendipity, and I said synchronicity. It was not a coincidence. I don't really believe in coincidences anymore. And we had a wonderful conversation there. And I am just so glad to have her with us this morning. So I'm going to introduce my once acquaintance, now dear friend, CJ. Welcome, CJ.
Thank you.
So good to have you here this morning.
I'm honored.
And I would love for you, and I know we got to talk about this some at the park. What I find fascinating is when you shared some of your story at the park of how you were raised, I didn't get any hints of trauma, of religious trauma, of being forced to believe something you didn't want to believe. I just found it very refreshing and fascinating, actually, that you were raised in this environment, fostered with freedom to follow the leadings of your own heart. So refreshing. You grew up in a religious home, And yet you are able to maintain an open, questioning mind, the mystery of it all. You are always willing and ready to learn and grow spiritually. And that is just amazing to me because we are both in the, let's say, the second half of our time on this planet. And my awakening came as a result of a lot of religion and a lot of guilt and shame and dysfunctional family that led to suffering, that finally led to surrender, which led to that awakening. So it's wonderful to hear that people really are raised in good homes. So I'm going to turn it over to you and ask you just to share some of your story with us this morning.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that, Rick. I've always just been very thankful for my family. The older I get, the more I realize how blessed I was to have the parents I had, the grandparents I had. Yes, my dad was a Baptist preacher when I was growing up. And my parents were, how do I put this? They were not like so many of my friends' parents. They were educated. They were just very open-minded about things. Dad was not one of those strict, well, I mean, he was pretty strict, but as far as making us abide by the rules, you know, it was kind of unusual. Well, I probably should give you a little background on who my parents were. My mother was born in 1918, the day after World War I ended. And her mother's brother actually delivered her. Her mother's brother was a doctor, a little country doctor over in Lee County and Newton County. But he delivered, and he told her not to have any more babies, because she almost bled to death. And so my papa, her daddy, was kind of disappointed he didn't get a boy, and that he couldn't have any more and try again for a boy, you know. Mm-hmm. And so she grew up as an only child. She was nicknamed Jack at a very young age. Her name was Catherine Olita. But one of the men that worked for my papa, he was in the timber business, the Vance brothers in Newton County, and said, well, Mr. Vance, if she'd been a boy, what were you going to name her? And he said, well, I was going to call him Jack. Well, you can call her Jack. Mm. So he went home and started calling this baby girl Jack. And it stuck. My grandmother also called her Jack, and all her friends called her Jack. So rather than Catherine Olita, which was her real name, mm-hmm. She was known as Jack her entire life. but she was quite a protege. She was musically talented from the time she could reach the keyboard on a piano. And she would hear something on the radio, and she'd go to the piano and tinkle out the tune on, you know. Mm-hmm. So she was in the small town of Walnut Grove, Mississippi. She was kind of a celebrity child, yep. Because she was so talented and she was so smart. And she skipped grades because she was, you know, she already knew all this syndrome. So she wasn't but 15 when she graduated from high school. But let me back up. When she was 12 years old was when she met my daddy. My daddy and his daddy was a Baptist preacher, and my daddy at the time was working with him as a revival team. My granddaddy would preach, and my daddy was leading the singing. And they had come to the Baptist church in Walnut Grove to lead a revival. And he got the choir together on a Sunday afternoon and said, "Who's going to play the piano?" Nobody was sitting at the piano. "Jack will, Jack will," everybody said. And so here comes this skinny little 12-year-old down the aisle, pressing down the aisle, you know. And she gets down to the piano bench and adjusts it, you know, and sits down. And he leans over kind of condescendingly. "Honey, what can you play?"
She showed him.
She looks up at him and she said, "Well, honey, what can you sing?" And so he never had any more doubts about what she could play, you know. But he was 22 at the time, and she was 12.
Mm, yep.
So that was their first encounter. That was in 1930. Wow. Daddy went on to, of course, the Depression was going on. Daddy went on to the CCCs. Have you ever heard of the CCCs?
No.
Civilian Conservation Corps. During the Depression, a lot of people did public work for the government, but they got a little paycheck, and he always was helping his mama. And he was stationed in Louisiana, and he met a woman over there, and they married, and he was feeling the call to the ministry. And so they moved to Texas, and he went to the Baptist Seminary in, where is it, Fort Worth?
I'm not sure.
But Dallas, somewhere over there, the Southern Baptist Seminary. And while they were there, his wife got pneumonia and died.
Oh my.
And so he was you know, a young man, and very much wanted to be a father, and here his first wife had died already. Well, his daddy at this point was living in Texas, and he went down to stay with him for a few days and grieved the loss of his wife, and they became close again. They had become distant, but they became close again. And in 1942, mother and daddy met first in 1930 when she was 12 and he was 22. Mm-hmm. In 1942, after daddy's first wife had died and he was visiting his daddy, his daddy said, "Do you remember that little 12-year-old girl in Walnut Grove that played the piano for us?" "Yeah." "Well, she's 24 now, and she's not married, and she's real pretty. You need to go back to Mississippi and look for her." Well, I think I will. He had gotten out of the CCCs by that time, and had actually signed up. I mean, he enrolled in the Army. And he was going to be a Protestant chaplain rather than a Baptist preacher, which he had been trained for. But in the Army, he was going to be a Protestant chaplain. So the Army had sent him to a chaplain school at Harvard. Wow. Where he was trained in the different denominations, Protestant denominations, so he could minister to different denominations on the battlefield, you know, out where they were going. And So he had just gotten out of chaplain school, and that's when he decided he'd make the trip down to Walnut Grove, Mississippi, and look up this little girl he had met when she was 12. And she was 24, and she was single. And by that time, like, I don't know if I told you this while ago or not, but she wasn't but 15 when she graduated from high school.
Yeah, you mentioned. Yeah.
So she had been working. She won a scholarship to Blue Mountain College, but her mama wouldn't let her go because she wasn't but 15 years old. You're too young to leave home. Mm. She went to work as a bookkeeper for the lumber company there in Walnut Grove. And when her first cousin graduated from high school, 2 years younger than her, but they went to Jackson to Drones Business College. And she had made up her mind she wasn't going to get married. She was going to be independent. She wasn't going to have a husband telling her what to do. She wasn't going to have any kids tying her down that she had to take care of. And so she was what was called back then the Roosevelt Progressives. Her grandmother, I mean, my grandmother, her mother was very progressive also. I mean, she had worked.
Yeah, that is
the whole something. Time. And but anyway, mother had made up her mind that she didn't need a husband and she sure didn't need kids, and she was going to work and support herself and be independent. And all of a sudden, this handsome Baptist preacher shows up in Walnut Grove, and they got reacquainted, and it didn't take long that about 6 weeks after he came back to visit, she was having some real sweet feelings about
Smitten.
Him. And, and he was about her. So within 6 weeks, he persuaded her to marry him because he was about to be shipped out overseas for the battlefield. And so they got married in October of 42, and he served in France, and he served in England. And, oh, the stories he would tell about stuff he went through over there. Mm-hmm. Not only was he a Protestant chaplain, he was a medic. They had trained him in first aid, too. He used to have to go to the front lines of the battlefield and pray for the wounded, you know, and help get them back to the hospital and pray for the ones who were dying. And didn't have a gun or anything. I mean, you know, had a Red Cross on his sleeve, but as far as he knew, he never got shot at. So... But his prayer for the ones who were dying, he didn't ask them if they were saved. He told them, he used that Bible verse, I think it's in Romans, about nothing can separate you from the love of God. Whether they were professed Christians or not, they were going to be reunited with God. You know, God loved them. And
do you think that, I just listening to you, and you mentioned it to me before, how he had to learn all of the different religions,
denominations.
You know, I mean, you mentioned education, which is a big key in people being,
right,
having an open mind, but then to be placed in a position where you have to learn them all.
Right.
Perhaps you never get to a place where you think, I've cornered the market on the right one.
Well, he had a very open, Daddy was always very ecumenical. He had a profound respect for whatever denomination you came from.
That's beautiful.
But anyway, they got married and he shipped out. And so mother, while he was overseas, mother went back to Jackson. Her first cousin was still living in Jackson. She came back to Jackson, and they worked for the telephone company as switchboard operators. during the war. And so he got home on New Year's Day, 1946. And his arrival was in New Orleans, where his sister and his mother lived. And she and her cousin made the trip down to New Orleans to be there when he got in. And he got off the plane, and the first thing he said to her was, "I'm ready to start a family. I hope you are too." So 11 months later, here I am. Yep. But anyway, I was born in El Paso, Texas. He had not been discharged from the Army yet.
Okay.
He was at Fort Bragg, I think is what's in El Paso. Anyway, I was born in El Paso. And as soon as he was discharged in January of 47, they moved back to Walnut Grove, to where her parents were, and he started looking for a church, you know, that he could pastor. And and he was going to several different churches, filling in for pastors that were, you know, had to be out. And I don't know how the word got around, but he was available, you know, and he filled in several places. And he got a call to the Baptist Church in Noxapater, Mississippi. You ever heard of Noxapater? No,
it's a tongue twister, like a lot of them are for me, from Massachusetts. But yeah.
Well, Noxapater is a little town in Winston County. So my earliest memories are Walnut Grove, but most of my earliest memories are of Noxapater, where he pastored the church there from 48 to 52. And I have very fond memories of Walnut Grove and Noxapater. But then he accepted a call from Plantersville Baptist Church, which is in Lee County, right outside of Tupelo. And we moved to Plantersville in 1952. My mother, by that time, had 3 babies. My sister came along 15 months after I did. Mm-hmm. My brother came along 2 years after she did. So within 3 years and 3 months, she had had 3 babies. This woman that was not going to have children. And yeah. But when they moved when they were not in Noxapater, she went to work for a lumber company in Louisville. Then when we moved to Plantersville, she moved her parents up with us. They had my granddaddy wasn't in the lumber business anymore, and my grandmother was very much wanting to be involved with her grandchildren. You know, she was very maternal, and mother figured out that if I take my parents with us and let them live with us, they can help raise the children and I can go to work like I wanted to. Mm. And so in 52, my parents, and their 3 kids and 2 grandparents moved into the Baptist parsonage in Plantersville, Mississippi. It was a 2-bedroom, 1-bath home.
Yikes.
Picture that. But there was room in there for everybody, believe it or not. My sister and I shared a bedroom. My grandmother and granddaddy had a room that I think was probably built for a den in the back of the...
Yeah.
And my brother had a little bunk in what had been the pastor's study between the kitchen and the dining room.
You fit them where you can. Yeah.
And so anyway, it was not the ideal situation, but you know, it worked for us. So, but I grew up, my school life was, I was what they called scatterbrained. I was very fidgety, didn't want to pay attention to the teacher. I was always doing something else, drawing pictures or whispering with my neighbor, you know, or, you know. And every one of my teachers would tell me, Kathy, you could be making straight A's. Well, back then it was S's and D's.
Oh, I remember that too.
Satisfactory and dissatisfactory. And I was always satisfactory, but then they started doing A's and B's, and I was satisfied with B's. It didn't bother me a bit that I didn't get an A. But anyway, I was 50 years old when I found out, yes, you were ADHD, because my son came along about the same way, you know. But I was fussed at the whole time I was in school because I wasn't applying myself, you know. And so anyway, let's see, when I was in the eighth grade, my best friend and I were sitting on the bus one day, and we had been to Woolworth's dime store and bought nail polish. And we were on our way home from school, and the cute Borden twins were sitting in front of us, Richard and Robert. And we were sitting back there painting our nails with our nail polish. And they turned around, y'all put that up, that stinks.
Yeah.
And so I just took the nail polish and painted the back of Richard's neck. Oh, you know, he just jumped up and grabbed my books and threw them out the bus window. And so I was screaming and carrying on, you know, and the bus driver happened to also be the school principal.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that always helps.
He stopped the bus and came back there and wanted to know what in the world was going on. And he made Richard go get my books, you know, and bring them back. And he said, in my office, first thing in the morning, all four of us had to go to the office the next morning. So Tanya and I never had to go to the principal's office before. Richard and Robert had been in there several times. And we got in there and they were telling, don't worry, he doesn't spank that hard. Back when, you know, principals used to spank kids.
Old enough to remember that myself.
But anyway, our punishment was Richard and I had to sit on the front row right behind Mr. Griffin. And Tanya and Robert had to sit on the other front seat so he could keep an eye on us. And that's when Richard and I became sweethearts, was having to sit on the... on the bus together. He was in the ninth grade. I was in the eighth grade. And so we were sweethearts all through high school. And when we were seniors in high school, in fact, yesterday was the 60th anniversary of when we got married, but... I came in one Saturday. I mean, I was getting ready to go out one Saturday night, and Mother and I had a little argument about going to the drive-in. You're not supposed to be going to the drive-in. Oh, Mama, we go to the drive-in all the time.
Little did you know.
You remember drive-in movies?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Good place to fog up the windows. But anyway... I said, and we were arguing, you know, and Richard hadn't gotten there yet. I said, and besides that, I think I'm pregnant. And Mother just threw up her hands, and, you know, Daddy had come in by that time, could hear the arguing between me and Mama. came in there and he's, honey, do something with her. So I had to tell Daddy, you know, what I just told Mama.
Yeah.
He said, we'll take care of it. And Richard got there and he congratulated him.
Yeah, that must have been a little awkward.
And anyway, Richard quickly figured out that he knew what the situation was and that he was planning on him being his son-in-law. You know, Richard was quite in favor of that too. You know, what do 17 and 18-year-old kids know? Yeah.
And my sister was, she had her first child at 17.
Well, anyway, the next morning in church, and I was sitting in the choir right behind my daddy in the pulpit, he tells everybody, well, we got some good news last night. We found out that Kathy and Richard have been married for several months, and we're expecting our first grandchild. And I'm like, Daddy. You know, I'm sure my face was... But my best friend was, Tanya was sitting next to me in the choir, and she said, you did not.
I didn't get an invitation to the wedding, yeah.
Anyway, of course, after church, I had to ask him, how in the world can you stand in the pulpit and tell something like that? You know that's not true. Well, that's when he said, according to Jewish tradition, marriage begins with consummation. So that's when I learned what consummation means. And according to that definition, yes, we'd been married for several months. So anyway, the next day he carried us to Jasper, Alabama. Over there, it could be done in one day. In Mississippi, it still took 2 days. You had to get a blood test. And then, you know, anyway, we were still seniors in high school. Mm-hmm. So we had to take a day out of school and go to Jasper, Alabama and get married. And his dad went with us. And we got it all taken care of. Got married in the First Baptist Church in Jasper, Alabama. I think it was right across from the courthouse. Flowers were still in there from Sunday. Yeah. The church secretary came in there to be the second witness, and Daddy tied that knot real good.
Yep.
So, anyway, next day we were back in school and finished school, and Richard had decided he was going to be an architect. I had taken mechanical drawing as a senior in high school. No girl had ever wanted to do that before. But I had decided I was going to be a draftsman if he was going to be an architect. I'd learned drafting and, you know, we'd work together. And so he was going to Drones Drafting College in Nashville. So when we graduated from high school, we moved to Nashville. And that was an adventure. I mean, I had lived in two little small towns my whole life and never lived in the city, and I loved it. I mean, it was an adventure every day. I got a job. My daddy knew the man who was over the Baptist, the Southern Baptist, what do they call it? Baptist Sunday School Board, where all the literature for the Baptist churches were printed. He knew the man that was over all that. They'd been friends growing up. And so he called him. They put me to work as a file clerk, you know. So, but it was in downtown Jackson. And, I mean, downtown Nashville. So I had an adventure. I'd get out and walk at lunchtime, you know, and just explore downtown Nashville. I loved it. And I had worked there for, let's see. I didn't work there but a few months. Then I heard about an opening at the Federal Reserve Bank. A friend of mine at the Baptist Sunday School Board had gone to the Federal Reserve Bank, and she told me about an opening over there. And I went to work over there at the Federal Reserve. And after that, well, Richard was going to night school at the University of Tennessee. They had a branch in Nashville, and it was right, I mean, the Sunday School Board, the Federal Reserve Bank, and the UT University Center were all within walking distance. I mean, all these things that I was involved in, and Richard had to go to UT to sign up and take some college courses. And so I went with him over there, and while I was there, the administrator of that center came out and started talking to me, and they needed a receptionist and telephone operator for the front desk. And he asked me if I was interested in it. He said, you've got the right personality. This is, you know, this is an opening. If you're interested, we'll hire you. Okay. Paid more than what I was making and be over there where he was. And, you know, it sounded like the ideal thing to me.
Was that the beginning of your multiple-year career, or was that, because I know that you did that for a number of years, right?
Well, that was my first experience with a switchboard.
So that's where your experience came in that got you into the at the
phone. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but anyway, while I was at UT was when I got pregnant with my second child. We'd had Ricky in Tupelo in 64. That was my firstborn. And we had been living in Nashville, but I went back to Tupelo every month for my doctor visit, and I was in Tupelo. I was at my parents' house when I went into labor and had Ricky. And we then shortly moved back to Nashville with my husband. And then I got pregnant with my second child, Benji, while I was working at UT. And so after I had Benji, I'd kind of decided I was going to stay at home and take care of my boys because I loved my kids. I loved being a mother. There was nothing more satisfying to me than taking care of my boys and playing with them and seeing them grow and just watching their development. And I loved it. And so I decided I was going to stay at home and take care of my boys and be a housewife and all that. And I started selling Avon. I could work from home, you know, and at the time we had a brand new mobile home. And so the trailer park was big enough that I had Avon customers everywhere. Yes. But, you know, I could stroll the kids around and deliver Avon to my customers and go that back works. Home with my kids. I thought it was a nice arrangement. But Richard and I were having real difficulties getting along. And so I just, his language was not something I wanted my boys to hear. I did not want them to grow up talking like that. I mean, profanity was quite common in his family. And I wasn't used to that. I did not like that. I didn't want my boys learning all that and copying that behavior. And so I finally, you know, I tried to get Richard to quit doing that. You know, you're setting an example for the boys that I don't want them to have. And I finally just made up my mind one day, you're going to have to get them out of this if you don't want them growing up just like this. And I didn't. You're going to have to get them out of here. And so he and I separated. And I rented a trailer in the trailer park, you know, not far from where he was, but it was separate housing. And I'm still selling Avon. And I realized I had to have more money than what Avon was giving me. And so I went downtown looking for a job. I had read back when jobs were advertised in classified ads in the paper, you know, and one of the places that was hiring was South Central Bell. And so I went downtown and before I left that day, I said, Lord, you know, I'm going to have a good job if I'm going to raise these two kids by myself. And first place I went was the phone company, and they hired me just like that. Mm-hmm. And okay. And so it wasn't long after that that I found an attorney and filed for divorce. And my daddy actually came up and testified on my behalf. I was filing on the grounds of, what did they call it back then? Wasn't emotional abuse, but it was something I don't like that. I can't remember what they called it. But, and he testified that he had witnessed some of this, you know, and that he didn't want his grandchildren growing up in that atmosphere, and that Richard was just, you know, not doing what he needed to do to be a good husband and good father. So the divorce was granted, and, I lived in Nashville until I had 6 months service with the phone company. Then I transferred to Tupelo. Went back to live with mother and daddy and worked for the phone company. And I, the week I started in Tupelo was the week that Hurricane Camille had hit the coast. This was years before Katrina. Camille was back in the 69. And so my introduction to the phone company in Tupelo was quite harrowing. Mm. People trying to find people, no telephone lines, a telephone down everywhere, you know, and we were trying to help them and could work all the overtime we wanted and all that. And so, anyway, my parents, in the meantime, had, my dad had resigned from his Baptist church in Plantersville in 65. He and his deacons had had a big disagreement about civil rights. Daddy was actually an admirer of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And he had tried to persuade the deacons that it's coming, and we're Christian, and we're going to be civil about it. Oh, no, we're not, you know, and they wouldn't hear of it. And they would not agree with him on anything. And he had begun to do some substitute. He was licensed to teach, too. He had begun to do some substitute teaching with the county school system. So he retired, I mean, he resigned from his Baptist church and became a full-time school teacher with the Lee County school system. So when I moved back with him, Daddy was a school teacher and Mother was still working. She had become a secretary to the vice president of a bank in Tupelo, but two-bedroom house, but did have two baths. But the boys and I shared a bedroom, and mm-hmm. and Mom and Daddy shared a bedroom. And
did your dad ever talk about that, you know, what you just shared about the kind of the division, that schism in the church where he, you know, for civil rights and what he stood for? And did he ever talk about what his beliefs were? And
he did. And Daddy belonged to a group in Tupelo that was kind of started by the newspaper publisher up there. He was very progressive. And there were several businessmen and people in Tupelo who got together for coffee quite regularly. And they had planned out what they were going to do when they had to integrate the schools. And Tupelo and Lee County were some of the only schools in Mississippi that did not have riots. They did not have white flight. Mm-hmm. They integrated very peacefully. And Daddy was a part of that. That has just always impressed me so. He went to work, when he resigned from the church, he went to work for the county school system, but then he went to the Tupelo school system. And the year before the students integrated, they had some white teachers go to the black school and some black teachers come to the white school. And Daddy was one of the white teachers that went to the black school. And he and the principal and all the teachers, they got along fine. He loved it. And the next year, the student body, you know, was integrated, and he stayed down there. That became the ninth grade. Mm-hmm. That the Carver High School became the ninth grade, and the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade were the high school. And so he stayed there until he retired at age 65. But in the meantime, Mother, being the musician that she had been, after they resigned from the Baptist Church in Plantersville, Mother had been the organist and pianist and whatever else they needed down there. She quickly got drafted to a Methodist church in Baldwin, Mississippi, and Daddy started going up there to church, to the Methodist church. His mother had been a Methodist, so he was, mm-hmm. and, you know, he was ecumenical anyway, and it didn't bother him in the least. So they started going to the Methodist church in Baldwin. And while he was there, he became good friends with the district superintendent, who got him to filling in for the Methodist preachers that happened to be out on Sunday, you know. And so he did that part-time in addition to teaching school. And when he retired at 65, Brother Appleby, the district superintendent, sent him to Emory University to get credentialed as a Methodist minister. From age 65 to age 80, Daddy was a circuit-riding Methodist yeah. preacher.
What I hear in your story, because I don't have a lot of time, but what we're hearing your story and what seems to be the thread, and it started when you're talking about your grandmother and her being progressive, mm-hmm. and that period of time and how foreign that was, you know what I mean? And then you just see the hints of not only the progressiveness, but then, you know, your dad and the openness and the education and being open to all, I see that in you today. You know, I see that openness and willingness to rethink and to not being afraid to question, and all of that has just traveled on with you. And that's what I picked up too when we were sitting in that park that day, that, you know, it's never too late to take a step back and question what you believe. And I mentioned before we started that I had something I wanted to share with you because I wanted to get your take on it. But Since my life has changed over the last 5 years, and it really catapulted in getting sober, and doing the 12-step work and taking a look at myself and my personal inventory. And like when you share your story, the details that you remember, I'm just like, I can't even imagine all of that. I don't have that kind of memory. You know, I was number 5 out of 6 kids, but I don't have the detailed memory of, I didn't even know my grandfather's first name until probably 10 years ago. He died when I was like 2 or 3, my father's father. And you know, just how far you can go back and the detail that you remember, you have a mind like a steel trap. I find that amazing. But anyway, I was sharing something. I'm getting in trouble. I'm getting in trouble lately on Facebook and sharing things that apparently I shouldn't be sharing. I don't know, but I shared something that's Elaine, our friend Elaine, mm-hmm. posted. And a friend of mine from years ago, church days, I don't have many of those left, that I'm close with anyway today, commented on this reshare of this post with concern for my soul, thinking that, you know, I have been bewitched, is what the term she used. Yeah.
I think I saw that.
And that I've fallen. And you know, when I shared with her, you know, I felt something when I read that, and it brought me back to a time when I felt that before. And it was my very first spiritual experience when I came home all excited that I had met a God that I finally recognized as loving, you know, and my brother Bob, who had become Baptist and wanted us all as Catholics to become Baptists, and, you know, the division, and, you know, you've got to be over here and not over there. And it was just... he would hand us little pamphlets, you know, the pamphlets that they called them tracts. And, mm-hmm. you know, he would say, you need to read this. And I'm like, well, what about someone in Zimbabwe that, you know, they may never get this. He said, don't you ever worry about them. You just worry about your own soul. And, and so I had this experience and I came home excited about this experience. And he came running out in the kitchen to hear about it. And I told him that, you know, I think I met God that I found out as loving and kind tonight. And he's like, well, where was this at? And I said, it was at a Bible study at a karate school hall that they rented. Oh, you haven't found God. You're in a cult. And you know, that I was so excited in it, initially, and then I was just distraught. Like, oh my goodness, what if I am in a cult? What if this is not real? What if all these wonderful feelings I'm feeling are... And I went into my room and, you know, I was totally distraught that I had lost something. And this thought just dropped into my head like a coin in a piggy bank that came from nowhere that said, see how much you love me already that you'd be this upset to think you've lost me. I didn't know where that came from, but all I know is that I was filled with this peace. And she brought me back with that comment. It brought me back to that message of my brother's. And when I looked at, I was with Glenn in the car and I'm like, oh my gosh, today is March 23rd. That was the date of that experience 42 years ago.
Wow.
And here it was happening again, you know, that, and yet I have 42 years of experience to know that I don't have to go there now.
Yes.
I know what I have.
Good.
So I don't know if you ever deal with, you know, that the struggle of folks not being comfortable with where you are at.
Well, probably the most discomfort I feel. My oldest son, one of the sweetest, smartest people you will ever know in your life, turned out to be a real Southern Baptist, you know, and they're still in that mindset of you're either saved or you're lost, you're going to hell, you're going to heaven, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And I have never bought into that. When I made my profession of faith at age 7, Baptists did what they call walking the aisle. I didn't have mm-hmm. to walk the aisle because I was sitting on the front seat because so Daddy could keep an eye on us. But he had just preached a sermon on, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If you'll open the door of your heart, I'll come in and live in your heart. Well, I had been taught from birth that Jesus lived in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over and I asked my daddy. I said, is Jesus outside my heart or is he inside my heart? And he picked me up, hugged me, and he said, darling, Jesus has never left your heart and he never will. Mm. And next Sunday he baptized me and made me a Baptist, you know. But I was never told that I was a dirty, rotten sinner in need of salvation.
Do you know what a miracle that is? That is just, you have been blessed. That is a miracle to have a dad, you know, in that era that saw things the way your father did. And it has traveled on through you. And I'm so grateful for that.
I mean, I grew up, like I said, my sister came along 15 months after I did. So my dad used to take me on his visitation to all he used to visit church members, you know, elderly, sick church members in their homes. And he would carry me with him. And the first song I ever learned to sing was, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam to shine for him each day. In every way, try to please him at home, at work, at play. A sunbeam, I'll be a sunbeam for him. Anyway, everywhere we went, they wanted to hear me sing. And they all loved me, you know. And I grew up thinking I was little Miss Sunbeam, you know.
And yet here you are, and you are still Miss Sunbeam. And I'm really grateful that you were here with me this morning and were able to share. And I look forward to our conversations continuing as life unfolds. Perfectly and in order. So, and I talked to you before too about Josh Scott, Pastor Josh Scott, and he's with Grace Point Church. And he was planning on visiting us and being on this podcast a few weeks ago and has had multiple things go on. He had a child that was sick and then he had COVID. And, but he's going to be here Friday evening. And if we could put up his banner, Danny, because you've probably seen some of his posts, CJ, but if it doesn't lead to flourishing for all humans, it isn't really good news, regardless of where you found it. I love that. The left behind theology needs to be left behind.
Oh, yeah.
He is a pastor. He's an author. I've had the chance to speak with him on Zoom. I'm really looking forward to it. And I did confirm yesterday that he will be here Friday. So I'm looking forward to that. And if you could put up the little video of the shot. This is my website. I'm really grateful you were here today. If you are struggling in any way at all, we would love for you to reach out. The best way to reach out is you can go to my webpage, and that is theawakencollective.org. There's contact links where you can reach out. All of our social media is out there. Coaching is out there. But go ahead out there and visit that site and let us know. Even if you want to send a word of encouragement, we all need encouragement, and I would love that too. I want to say thank you again to Daniel Anderson and Audio Alchemy Productions. Love you, Danny. So Friday night, 5 p.m. Central, will be our next one. Typically, we're on Sunday mornings, but we have a special guest, and some of our guests can only do evenings. So Friday night, 5 p.m., with pastor and author Josh Scott. CJ, thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Till next time, my friends. Love and kindness, always. Thank you.